Hi, everybody. Welcome to the City Council Chambers of Portland City Government. We're glad you're here. We just have a few rules of the room. One is, unless I authorize it, there's no clapping, there's no hooting, there's no hollering, there's no outbursts. This is a chamber for the free expression of ideas, including those that might be unpopular with other people in the room. So that's why we have that rule. If you like something, feel free to wave your hand. There's also been thumbs up, thumbs down. Please use this digit only. If you're authorized to lobby on behalf of a business or an organization, when you introduce yourself, just let us know who you're lobbying on behalf. And when you're invited up, you'll be invited up. Please state your name for the record. We don't want your address. We don't want your phone number. We don't want your email address. Just give us your name. And there's a clock in front of that piece of wood. And it will count down from three, unless we get a lot of people signing up, in which case we'll count down from two or one. But I think today we'll be okay. Before I gavel us into order, we've got some special announcements. And one of them is a group of folks from our sister city, Sapporo, Japan, from the Hokkaido Institute of Technology, with Professor Sakabe. Where are you all? Oh, well, they're up there. Hi. You can all clap and welcome them here. Watashi wa sam desu. Yeah. He was like, what are you saying? So glad you're here. Welcome. We've been sister cities with Sapporo for 52 years. It's one of our oldest relationships, and this is the fourth year that students from the Hokkaido Institute of Technology have visited us. I understand you'll be here for a three-week-long ESL program through the International Specials Program in the Office of International Affairs at Portland State University. So we're really glad that you're here. Welcome. And then we've got some other special...
Can I just note one thing?
Absolutely.
For those of you who love the Japanese garden, the world-famous Japanese garden here in Portland, it was actually craftspeople from Sapporo that helped design and build the garden. So that illustrates the great connection we have with the people of Sapporo, Japan.
You must visit the garden. Thank you, Commissioner. Our second special recognition is for our great AmeriCorps Vista workers. And if they could all stand up, all the guests. Great, glad you're here. And if you'd come forward while I read this proclamation. Whereas service to others is a hallmark of the American character, and throughout our history, citizens have stepped up to meet our challenges by volunteering in their communities. And whereas the AmeriCorps National Service Program has proven to be a highly effective way to engage Americans in national and community needs, in meeting national and community needs. And whereas AmeriCorps provides opportunities for more than 80,000 citizens across the nation, including approximately 156 members in Portland, to give back in an intensive way to the communities, our state, and our country, through AmeriCorps Vista, National Civilian Community Corps, and the state and national programs. And whereas more than 706,000 men and women, including more than 13,000 members from Oregon, have taken the AmeriCorps pledge to, quote, get things done for America since 1994, and whereas AmeriCorps volunteers for Oregon have served more than 15 million hours, helping to improve the lives of our state's most vulnerable citizens, respond to disasters, strengthen education, expand economic opportunity, provide health care, protect the environment, and support veterans and military families. And whereas AmeriCorps last year recruited and supervised more than 2.6 million community volunteers for the organizations they served and leveraged more than $480 million in additional resources. And whereas the residents of Oregon have earned more than $35 million in the Siegel AmeriCorps Education Awards to help pay for college or back student loans, and whereas AmeriCorps members after their terms of service end remain engaged in our communities as volunteers, teachers, public servants, nonprofit leaders in disproportionately high levels, Therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, of the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim March 10th through March 17th, 2012, to be AmeriCorps Week in Portland. Encourage all residents to observe this week. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. My name is Lauren Norland, and I'm an AmeriCorps Vista serving on behalf of the Mayor's Office Future Connect Initiative in partnership with Portland Parks and Recreation. And I just wanted to take a brief moment to reflect on the work our team has accomplished in the last few months. We've promoted post-secondary information and career opportunities to 18 community-based organizations, 5 Portland Parks and Recreation community centers, and 10 schools across 5 districts. The Future Connect Challenge engaged over 10,600 high school students, exposing them to events, activities, and experiences that promote post-secondary education access. And we've recruited volunteers to serve as mentors and teachers for at-risk youth. So as you can see, the partnership between the City of Portland and AmeriCorps is incredibly valuable. Together, we've made the path to post-secondary education stronger, positively impacting youth, their families, and our community at large. We'd like to thank Commissioner Fish for supporting the Future Connect initiative. Our work wouldn't be possible without the help of Portland Parks and Recreation teen programming. And we'd like to thank you.
You're just thanked.
Yeah, thank you. And we'd like to thank you, Mayor Adams, for your leadership in improving educational opportunities and access. The Future Connect initiative is critical to helping students find success at the next level and a key strategy to grow the greater Portland economy. We look forward to starting our second year of service in the coming months. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, thank you all for your great service. The scholarship program is exceeding all expectations, and in large part, because of your great work. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can the other two please introduce yourselves and say what you do?
I'm Tabitha Boschetti, and I am also with the Future Connect Project at Mount Scott Community Center in their team program. It's excellent.
And I'm Marie Manuel. I'm the Future Connect Strategy Coordinator out in East Portland. Happy AmeriCorps Week.
Thank you very much for your service.
Thank you very much for your great work.
All right. Carla, can you please call the roll?
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Leonard? Adams?
Here. A quorum is present. We shall proceed with the 9:30 time certain. Can you what's that? Oh, sorry. We have 4 items on communications, and we need to do those before we do the time certain. Can you please read the title for item number 241?
Request of Michael Krupp to address council regarding who is to be the responsible adult and can be trusted to do the best thing for our city.
Hello.
Morning.
As we transcend the banal, we may reflect on the past and therefrom clearly see our future. As a body, this council has not been any worse than others elsewhere, maybe better. None of you favor the path we have been confronted by, slow municipal death by financial asphyxiation. I am certain that you're thankful to be somewhat insulated from the sound of the second shoe dropping, but you will certainly hear it. I know you will welcome the coming change. Commissioner Fritz has served our city for many years and is by far the most humane of you. She has suffered the most to accomplish what she has been allowed to. Recognizing the ineluctable forces that are upon us, she has selflessly chosen to step aside her incumbents in favor of the New People's Peace Party. This triumvirate of worthy souls will now enter this hall with grace and the overwhelming support of the 99%. We the people will then occupy 3/5 of this council. That would be a majority, and therefore we could govern by mayoral initiative. For her act of ultimate service to our community, she will be forever loved and remembered as the first of the last women to be dragged down by the vile machinations of men in power. And for his efforts as fire commissioner, Mr. Leonard has given us a department that is the beacon of hope and life for Portland and all of us. He as well will be greatly esteemed as the flower that gave birth to the heart of an eternal city of peace. In the trappings of a bully and living a life at odds to himself and all others, he has personally succeeded in delivering the goods. Two empty seats and a gleaming fire department shiny government for our children. For this single act, he will remain a living martyr who threw his ample political life into the fire, that the phoenix of a future may rise from the fire bureau. Eric, Prince of Darkness, as you are unable to engage me in a fair fight, and they won't give you a Black Hawk and a squad of drunken homicidal merrymakers to win fair and square, I challenge you to a staring contest, if you may speak for your own eyeballs. Thanks.
All right, can you please read the title for communications item number 242?
Request of Moses Rosen to address council regarding the fundamental human right of safe and warm sleep.
Morning. I only have 3 minutes, so I figured I'd prepare some handouts if you could give those.
I will.
Okay, great, no problem. I'm here this morning to talk about the fundamental human right to sleep. It's unfortunate that I even have to be here to talk about this. But here are the facts, Mr. Adams. All of us need a fair amount of sleep every day to live healthily. We spend a third of our lives sleeping. Another fact is that we are 7 years into our 10-year plan to end homelessness. We spent $47 million, and we have more homeless people now than we did when we started. Another fact is that the laws and ordinances of this city make safe and warm sleep illegal. So right now, the laws and ordinances of this city inhumanely illegalize a fundamental human need to survive. You're making existence illegal by the ordinances. Another fact is that on December 1st, I started an occupation of the plaza out here to bring focus and pressure to the city to do the morally right thing and address this issue within the ordinances that makes existence illegal. There has been somebody in occupation of the plaza for the last 4 months, at least one person, to bring pressure to the city on this issue. On March 2nd, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was awoken by police officers who handcuffed me, booked me, fingerprinted me, and detained me for 9 hours for sleeping on the sidewalk. Subsequently, the district attorney dropped the charges so that I am denied a jury trial and a right to a criminal lawyer. Meanwhile, the right to a court-appointed lawyer, excuse me. Meanwhile, my mugshot is now on the web, and I can clear that mugshot off the web for the low, low price of $100. Oh, man, I don't have time. India's Supreme Court just declared sleep a legal right. In 2009, a CIA report said that sleep deprivation is torture, noting that it's a primary method of torture because it's effective at breaking people. The Supreme Court of British Columbia ruled that it was unconstitutional for the city of Victoria to prevent
time
people
is up.
From erecting structures.
I need you to wrap up.
All right. I really will. Right now, the city is fining R2D2. The city should be funding R2D2. What they are providing is a sustainable sleep model.
Thank you.
All right, so
can you please, your time is up.
Thank you.
I gave you a little more time. Can you please read the title for 243?
I'd appreciate it if you'd take a look at these handouts.
243, request of Shedrick J. Wilkins to address council regarding the Star Needle, Oregon Space Needle for CBC Bridge.
Hi, welcome back. You need to state your name. You need to have a seat, and that clock in front of you will give you your 3 minutes.
I'm Shedrick Wilkins, and recently my daughter wanted to go to the Space Needle, and I'd like to create something in Portland, Oregon that's like the Space Needle. So I used my imagination and came up with this idea called the Star Needle. Now, recently, Oregon is able to make solar cells at Solar World. We're supposed to have a plant called Solar Power in Northwest Portland. My idea is to make a cross-shaped crane-like structure, right, that tracks the sun and promotes solar cell technology. The electricity would be stored in the bottom, and there'd be a telescope at the top. And this is, a lot of people have solar cells on the roof, but you really don't see them. You know, they're kind of hidden. And I like this to coincide with the construction of the CBC Bridge. Now, if anybody laughs at my idea, laugh at Astoria because they have the Astoria Column. Okay. But one thing about the Space Needle, it is a rotating restaurant made for the World's Fair in 1962 and doesn't serve any purpose at all. My idea is to make something where people could ride up at the top, right, and it generates electricity. Okay, so I would like to promote solar cell technology, and please support old Japan. If you like my idea, steal it, so we'll make one. So that's all I have to say, and I'm going to promote this idea because I think it's really neat. And originally when I thought about the CBC Bridge, I thought about making a giant windmill. I mean, you know, this thing has kind of evolved, and I read the papers, and even President Obama said in his speech that we need to really promote solar cells and batteries. And Oregon and Portland in general have no main attraction like the Space Needle or the Eiffel Tower. So my name Star Needle is just something, it's a play on the word Space Needle, and it's a functional art and science exhibit. And I'd like to see it. People could see it from any direction if it's near the bridge on the Oregon side to promote Oregon. Okay, that's enough. I'm going to really push my idea until maybe if it doesn't work, I'll ship it to Dallas, Texas or something, let them do it, or I'll send it to Japan. Okay,
thank you.
Thanks, Nell.
Carla, can you please read the title for item number 244?
Request of Joel Sim to address council regarding illegal fireworks being set off in residential neighborhoods within the city of Portland.
Good morning. My name is Joel Syme. I live in the South Trader View Edition area. That's the south of Mount Tabor in southeast Portland. I had a situation in my neighborhood that's been escalating the ignition of illegal fireworks. And per my household, I had a mother that was terminally ill and dying and was bedridden, and trying to contact the police through 911 and a non-emergency number, I did not receive any response. And I was very concerned about the safety issue about my house and my neighbor's house being set on fire by other neighbors setting off the illegal fireworks. My concern is there's stuff being done, but it seems like the proliferation of the illegal fireworks almost keeps me hostage in people where we have to stay at home and watch our houses, but because the city ordinances aren't being enforced concerning this issue. And it only comes up once a year. And I finally did get the police to show up at my house. And during our frank discussion about how I got them there, my neighbors continue to light off illegal fireworks in view of the city police, and they were more concerned about my situation or how I got them there versus the illegal fireworks that were the neighbors were setting off.
How did you get them there?
Well, I basically dialed 911 and hung up the phone.
Yeah, you shouldn't do that.
I know, but I had a bedridden mother that could not get out of the house, and she would.
Sir, when did this happen?
July 4th. They actually went over to, I found out later, they filed a report. They went over to the neighbors, talked to them. There was no arrests made. And
it's happened again?
Well, I don't know. I've got to wait for July 4th this year to find out.
So this happens just on July 4th?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm kind of concerned about the whole, it's just not me, it's just the whole area in general that I risk probably being thrown in jail for my actions, but I felt that the overlying situation that my mother couldn't get out of the house, that she died about 2 weeks later, that I was going to risk arrest versus.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Well, terrible. She was 92 years old, but I just.
Have you, and you've obviously talked to your neighbors and asked them not to do that?
Yes, I did. Actually, I talked to one of the neighbors who introduced me to some of the people that lives in this house, and whether or not they continue to do this remains to be seen.
Sir, I'd like to offer you another resource, and that is downstairs in that corner is the Office of Neighborhood Involvement.
Yeah.
And they provide the services of neighborhood mediation. And so in preparation for the next July 4th, they might be able to help you with communication and make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Well, I also got an email from Ern Jansen. He's I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. He's the chief fire marshal.
Aaron and she.
She.
Aaron Jansen. She.
She?
Yeah.
She sent me an email the next day after I signed up to come before the city council about this. And I've kind of been in the process of actually putting a new computer in my house. So I'm kind of getting back up to speed. But I want to contact her about this. And maybe we could be kind of more proactive in this situation. Because something's going to happen.
The good news is she's the new fire chief, and she's very dedicated to preventing illegal fireworks.
That's all I have to say.
Okay, so we'll wait for you to contact Aaron, and if you need additional assistance after that, then call the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, and they have mediation.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, I'd like, unless there are objections, take a point of personal privilege after we do the consent and hear the three items related to the Police Training Center, since they're all second reading. But before we do that, any items to pull from the consent agenda?
I kind of like having them here until we get through everything.
I know. But I think they have better work to do.
Is that an objection, Commissioner Leonard?
I didn't recognize him, so I didn't. Any items from the consent agenda you'd like to pull? All right, can you please call the vote on the consent agenda? It is reassuring.
Yeah, it is.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Consent agenda is approved. Let's do all three and save comments until the last one, if that's all right. Can you please read the title and call the vote for item number 266?
266, support the establishment of a training advisory council and the reaffirmation of the mission of the Portland Police Bureau. Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Approved. Can you please read the title and call the vote for item number 270?
Authorize acquisition of property at 14912 Northeast Airport Way from D. Ross Enterprises, LLC, by the Bureau of Internal Business Services for a training center complex for the Portland Police Bureau. Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
At the risk of being redundant, I'm going to repeat a couple of things I said last week because I think this is worth calling out. This training center has quite a history behind it. Beginning 5 years ago, Summit, the Police Bureau, proposed a training facility that would have cost from anywhere from $120 to $150 million, would have been located in Scappoose, and would have been located hopefully on land that continues to be zoned farmland. Some of us here objected to that, and it has only been since the arrival of Chief Reese and Mayor Adams as Commissioner in charge of the Bureau that an earnest attempt was made to find a facility in Portland within a reasonable budget and one that provided all the needs of the police bureau. Higher praise can't be given to Chief Reese for identifying this property, acquiring it for the use of the police bureau, and as he said last week, other agencies, the Fire Bureau, the Bureau of Water, Bureau of Transportation, other entities that need a driving facility. So this is at $15 million, probably about 10% of what was proposed to be spent. And I will tell you that was only on the hope that the zone would have changed from farming in Scappoose, again, Scappoose, Oregon, from farming allowing this construction. So this is a huge achievement for the police bureau, but particularly for Chief Reese and Mayor Adams, and I think it's important to note that at this time. Thank you for your great work. Aye.
Adams?
Am I voting last on this one? Aye. Can you please read the title and call the vote for 271?
271, authorize revenue bonds for police training facility. Fritz?
I concur with Commissioner Leonard's statement and thank Mayor Adams and Chief Reese for the way this package has been put together. I'm also grateful to Chief Reese for agreeing last week that we will have three members from the Community and Police Relations Committee from the Human Rights Commission on the Advisory Council, the Advisory Committee for this training facility, one of the officers, one of the Human Rights Commissioners, and one of the citizens at large. And I appreciate that understanding. I also need to clarify that the response to Commissioner Saltzman's question regarding the funding of these bonds. And I got a statement from the Office of Management and Finance that I think it would be helpful to read into the record so that we're all clear about how where this money is coming from. So a budget note was included in the financial year 11-12 budget directing the Office of Management and Finance to increase the 2012-13 appropriation level target for the police bureau by $1.785 million for 10 years in order to pay for this $15 million bond. So we decided that in the budget last year and set it aside. The $1.785 million in annual costs was included in the five-year forecast in December of 2011. So the money is coming from the general fund. There is no impact on water or sewer rates. And I'm supporting it, even though it is an impact on the general fund, which can also be used for housing and other important community safety and livability matters, because we have heard over and over again that the police believe that the training facility is necessary to coordinate their training and to provide better training so that we have better outcomes in the community. I will certainly be watching to make sure that that happens. But I do agree that this is a prudent purchase to do this at this time, at this cost. Aye.
Fish.
I want to echo what's been said. This council last year supported a budget note that dedicated general fund money over a 10-year period. And that is a significant commitment, and in a time when we're looking at a $17 million hole in our general fund and as little as $11 million of one-time funding, we have to be very careful when outside the budget process we allocate funds, no matter how important the need. After extensive time with Chief Reese and his team, I'm convinced that this is the right approach. And I really appreciate the time he has spent with counsel getting us to this point. I also want to, in light of Commissioner Leonard sort of providing some background and history, Mayor Adams, I want to acknowledge the work of the Parks Bureau that once upon a time was at the table working with your office and Chief Reese on another location that was contemplated at PIR. We thought at the time that that was a great marriage since it would allow us to use some of the property at Portland International Raceway, particularly the paved areas, and get a twofer. That did not work out because of some environmental issues and code issues, but I appreciated all the time that the Parks team spent at the table working out that particular option. I'm convinced this is the right way to go. Mayor Adams made this one of his commitments for his term, and today we honor that. And finally, it's not always that when we deal with something involving the police bureau and initiative that people on all sides of the issue come together. And I think it's worth noting that even people who are sort of critics of our bureau have observed that having a training facility and the opportunity to make sure we have the best trained police force in the country is vitally important to meet our mission and to provide good public safety and community policing. And that's the investment we're making today, and I think it frankly comes first. So I am pleased to support this. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Well, first, thanks to the men and women of the Portland Police Bureau that work so hard to keep us safe and to follow up when crime happens. You have a very difficult job, and I want you to know how much, as police commissioner, I appreciate the great work that you do and the efforts above and beyond what we strictly pay you to do that you do every day. To Chief Reese and Mike Kuykendall and the entire command staff and everyone at the Police Bureau, thank you for your great work on this. We looked at a number of sites, as Commissioner Fish noted. It was a little bit of, let's just say that the city is treated in the same way that every other potential development is treated in the city really well, except when the underlying zoning you find out isn't actually legal. So we learned, and we, I think, as a result of the good work and the attention of everyone on council, Commissioner Leonard, from the very beginning, he talks about the original proposal, but at the same time that he was rightfully raising questions about it, he was also always underlining the need for this facility. So thank you, and Commissioner, for his support as well. To Bob Keita, someone you don't know, but might not know, but is key. Oh, there he is. Now you will know him, Bob Keita, who does our facility work across the city. He's just absolutely fantastic. Thank you, Bob. To Brian Parman and Daryl Turner, who represent our workforce and organized labor. They've been incredibly supportive to the Crime Commission. And finally, Warren Jimenez, who this is his last city council session as my chief of staff. Commissioner Nick Fish stole him as the assistant director at Parks, and that was a very good steal, I might add. So, Warren, you've worked on this tirelessly as well, and I want to thank you for all your work. So with that, I am, and when I bang the gavel, even the police can clap for this one, okay? When I bang the gavel. So with that, I vote aye. Congratulations. And it is not rude to get up and leave at this point. We understand that you might not want to sit here for the rest of the day watching us do important work. So with that, can you please read the title for an equally important presentation? Time certain, item number 245.
Accept report on the Latino community in Multnomah County, an unsettling profile.
Please come forward. Please to help present, along with Commissioner Fritz, the next report on equity in the city of Portland. Commissioner Fritz, would you like to say anything to begin?
This is going to be an unsettling hearing because of the challenges we're faced by, and I appreciate the hard work that you have done to bring this to light. I appreciate the Coalition of Communities of Color presenting these as six separate reports, and I believe this is our fourth presentation to council, showing that for communities of color in Portland, things are not going well. And if we're not all doing well, then none of us are doing well, and we appreciate you being here to outline that for us and for the public at large watching and continue our commitment to addressing these issues.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. It's really good to be back at City Hall today. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Carmen Rubio. I'm the Executive Director of Latino Network, and we're a nonprofit that provides education, leadership, and family engagement programs for Latinos in Multnomah County. On behalf of my colleagues and many other Latino community members that are here today, we're very excited to present the Latino Report by the Coalition of Communities of Color. Our presentation agenda this morning includes key findings by Ann Curry Stevens, our researcher, and recommendations and a call to action from Pietro Ferrari and Victor Merced. Also, we have three community leaders joining us following this presentation to speak about the arts and culture, economic development, and other statewide efforts that are underway here at the city and in the state of Oregon. And that includes Dr. Carlos Crespo from the Oregon Latino Agenda for Action, Jose Gonzalez from Miracle Theater, and Gail Castillo from the Hispanic Chamber. The presenters and research are all part of the Coalition of Communities of Color, and we work to address the socioeconomic disparities, institutional racism, and inequity of services experienced by our families, children, and community. My colleagues and I are members, along with more than other 40 culturally specific organizations. And as a sponsor of this research, we want to say thank you for your leadership and your support for the development of this very important work. And because of your support, people now will be able to use this data to create more effective policies and make a deeper impact with the limited resources that we have today. So this research, it tells the story of Latinos in Multnomah County, how we're faring and where our work is cut out for us. So on a good note, it's exciting to hear that we're growing. Latino community has grown threefold since 1990, and we comprise nearly 12% of the total county population. But this news is tempered with the reality that our public institutions aren't yet really equipped or have the resources to adapt and serve this growing community, both culturally and linguistically. And with each new generation of Latino children entering school, we know it's critical to invest in the basics, and that includes education, safety, civic engagement, good jobs, accessible parks and affordable housing, and in the development of a growing and increasingly bilingual future workforce. I want to also acknowledge and appreciate this council's step to move in this direction, and specifically some of the work in arts and culture, planning, housing, and neighborhood involvement. These are important moves that really take us a step closer to a truly inclusive Portland community. And I'd like to call out some folks that are gems in the city and points of resource for us. Danielle Ledesma in housing, Alejandro Vidales in parks, Warren Jimenez, who is exiting the mayor's office and now soon to be in parks again, and also Amalia Alarcón of ONI. So these are great, amazing, incredible people that are important leaders and also important points of access for our community, and we hope that those numbers grow. We look forward to a deeper partnership with the city to address several of the issues raised today that still go unaddressed, and we hope to do this rooted in our community values of strength-based and family-centered approaches to community involvement and community development. So in closing, I just want to say we're so glad to be presenting to you today, and we consider you our friends with whom we know each of you shares this very core belief in equity and social justice. Our hope is that this research will continue to be a tool for everyone and for you to expand to the work to other bureaus and work to plan for the future and to make better strategic investments in where they are needed, ones that will continue to bring our community from out of the shadows and into the light of opportunity. I'll turn it over to Anne now.
Thank you very much. Anne Curry-Stevens from the Faculty of Social Work at Portland State University. The Latino community is growing very rapidly. We have, as Carmen mentioned already, a threefold increase over the last three decades. The community is primarily of Mexican descent, but also more than a quarter flowing from other regions of the continent. As you can see in the age distribution, we now have a situation with approximately slightly over 40% of the Latino community being under the age of 18. If you remember from our profiles and earlier reports, the preponderance of students of school age who are students of color. The Latino community is the fastest growing segment of communities of color. It is a very rapidly growing population. And in Carmen's words, she also spoke powerfully for the need for a bilingual workforce and also stronger bilingual programming in our school system to address these needs. The poverty levels of this community are very pronounced. We're looking at poverty rates compared to whites that are just shy of double that of the white community. Regardless of the age level, regardless of the family configuration, poverty rates are approximately a quarter of the population. Incomes are worse than half, meaning that communities do not have the affluence in order to pay for housing that is safe and affordable, to pay for food, and to support families to address crises that might come through issues of homelessness or issues of unemployment, or even to take risks in going back to school, for example. The community is deeply impoverished economically. This is a situation that has been worsening steadily over the last 20 years, with households earning below the mean, skyrocketing from 56 to 65% of the population, while that of the white community has held relatively constant. When we compare how the Latino community is doing here compared to national averages, to the left-hand side of this chart, you see the economic hit, the economic cost of being associated with living in this region, where individuals, families, retirees, single parents are unable to approximate the levels of income that on average they are elsewhere in the nation. And to add insult to injury, there is an economic perk for whites in living in this region where the finances of white families, white individuals, is higher than the national average, which adds to this complexing duality of racism and institutional challenges faced by communities of color, coupled with the relative perks that come associated in being white.
Can you give that statistic over? The white versus?
So the white community receives a perk in living here. So the finances, the annual earnings, are higher than their national averages. That's coupled with an experience for communities of color and for the Latino community of suffering worse economic prospects here at the same time that whites suffer this or experience this perk. When we look at occupations, you could imagine that occupational challenges are simultaneously tied to incomes and poverty rates. What we see on the left-hand side of the chart, that a presence in the best of jobs, in our management and professional jobs, our Latino community is unable to access those better-paying jobs. They are highly overrepresented in service industry, and we also, even in Multnomah County, but more pronounced across Oregon as a whole, are highly overrepresented in fishing, farming, and forestry. And so there's a preponderance of occupational segregation where the Latino community is unable to access better jobs and is overrepresented in worse jobs. Particularly troubling is what this economy has done to the Latino community by way of unemployment. Unemployment rates were already at 7.2%, almost double that of the white community back in 2007. By 2009, the unemployment rate had doubled for the Latino community up to over 14%, where it was also troubling for whites with an increase, but the disproportionality has skyrocketed in these measures. If you can imagine what does it take in terms of sustaining the Latino community in solid jobs, the community really needs support in order to get a better toehold, a better stance in terms of our more reliable, more durable, better protected, better economically protected industries. I'm going to turn to a bit of a look at how our service systems are meeting the needs of the Latino community. And what we begin with is the public housing access. And while these results are better than the 2009 data we looked at in our first report, there is still significant underrepresentation of the Latino community in terms of access to public housing and access to housing vouchers. The work of Daniel Ledesma and her leadership has been pronounced in terms of bringing an equity lens to these issues, and we're anticipating stronger results in the years to come.
Just if I could ask for your clarification, and yes, Danielle does a wonderful job, so I have to get that out of record. She's here. Tenant-based voucher participants, you're referring to the Section 8 program,
yes,
which is the largest housing program in the state of Oregon. Here in Multnomah County, it's about 8,000 vouchers, and the value to our community is about $50 million. That's administered by Home Forward. When you say public housing residents, are you referring to residents of Home Forward properties, or are you using public housing to describe the haciendas of the world, the community-based groups that provide affordable housing, along with, let's say, or Catholic Charities, along with Home Forward? Because sometimes we conflate the two, but we see them also as separate and distinct.
I would need to go back to the original report to recall that.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. And the reason I ask, in part, is that the city, Home Forward, has a separate board and a separate charter. Mm-hmm. The city invests in affordable housing. So as we think about remedies going forward, it's important to know who actually has the authority, mm-hmm. and then how do we influence policy.
Home ownership, then, is similarly challenged for the Latino community. We're looking at where incomes are the same. We're looking at access levels that are about half for the Latino community compared to whites. This is a really important feature of asset development, of an ability to save for the future, of an ability to stabilize and have some control over one's housing. And regardless of the income level, the Latino community is unable to access levels of home ownership, which are important to the community and for family well-being. Turning to the education system, the Latino community has very, very high levels of those who have not graduated high school. We had been very hopeful that this was a pattern that was changing rapidly, and you'll see in the next few slides that the sense of hopefulness that this rate will change anytime soon is very small. I also draw your attention to the figures over at the right-hand side of the chart, which shows that access to higher education is very compromised amongst this community. And in fact, and you'll see in a later slide, that it has actually been shrinking in recent years.
And presumably that whole slide was of people 18 and over?
Of people 25 and over. So it's the biggest, broadest scope around the population. We now have the data for what's happening currently in the education system.
Thank you.
So this is the data that says, how are our high school graduates doing today? And we can see overall in Multnomah County that we're looking at more than half of the students not graduating high school on time who are Latino. It is not a great figure for the white students either, but is significantly improved compared with the Latino community.
Professor, may I just ask, there was a story in the paper the other day about some challenges we have tracking students who leave the district and may graduate somewhere else on time or not.
Yes.
Does this data have that inherent challenge in terms of tracking students who move between districts?
As best as our school boards understood that, this is factored in. But then the challenge came from Betsy Hammond's article that deciphered that the 2011 data, which showed significant improvements over this 2010 data, was primarily the result of finding some additional students who had moved and factoring them back in. So this is undercounting. What we don't know is how those differences affect communities of color compared to white communities, that sort of differential having lost some of them. So this is a good profile around the approximate scenario. Does that explain? Suspension and expulsion rates are pronounced and have widened. It's an important pattern to notice that the disparities today are worse than they were 5 years ago, although there was some significant improvements from 07-08 to 08-09. They're still much wider. This is the suspension or expulsion over the course of the school year.
What's interesting under those numbers is that it's consistent. It's sadly and amazingly consistent across schools.
Yes.
Even if it's a majority white or a majority or a plurality Latino, it's still the same disparity in suspensions.
Absolutely. And here we have a breakdown by school boards showing the Latino community is most deeply challenged by differential suspension and expulsion practices in Gresham-Barlow and followed by Park Rose and David Douglas, both at more than 20%. Sorry. David Douglas is slightly less than 20%. For students who who have limited English proficiency, the graduation rate drops precipitously to a point that more than 60% of Latino students are not graduating today who have limited English. And those numbers vary by school boards, none of them being a hopeful prospect. College access, we mentioned that there are some deteriorating situations. What we have here is a shrinking level of the Latinos the Latino community accessing higher education over the last 5 years.
Why don't we have any later numbers than 2005?
The numbers had not been developed. This was done by survey data, and they're aiming to replace this with a constant tracking system that moves into higher education, and those results haven't been available yet. What we did look at is graduation rates through degrees awarded up in higher education, and over the last 10 years, we have moved from 3.2% to 4.2% of degrees awarded are going to those from the Latino community. But given that over this time period, the numbers of the community jumped considerably, we actually have a worse proportional situation today as of 2008 compared to a decade earlier. Health insurance is an important ability for one to survive, both health and illness, but also to return to the workforce after illness. And here we have levels that are about three times higher for the Latino community in terms of those living without health insurance. Turning to the juvenile justice system, this was a shining beacon for Multnomah County, especially in the area of detention rates, about a decade ago, where we eliminated disparities in the race and ethnicity of youth we were placing into detention. Today, that disparity is pronounced, has grown considerably, and is no longer the sense of hopefulness around equality in treatment through the justice system has diminished considerably. So everything from police charging rates to being brought to detention to being detained, there are considerable disparities facing the Latino community. The community also has less access to diversion programs that would funnel them outside of the system. The adult justice system, disparities are growing. There's a widening gap. A stable level of whites in terms of being incarcerated across the state, and a deteriorating level, more Latinos are being incarcerated. This is the profile, this is the last data slide we have for you to show where changes have been made over the last 3 years. It's a fairly dense chart. The full report has an easier to read version of it. Where we have green hours, we actually have an improving situation. This is not to say that disparities don't exist, because they're very pronounced in all of these features, but the gap is narrowing. And so the places where the gap is narrowing is in education and some in poverty levels and occupational trends. What we do have is fairly mixed picture in terms of income, deterioration in terms of health, unemployment, criminal justice systems, and housing. And so some of those features are places where we can be more proactive, and we're aiming for that kind of partnership across all levels of government to improve outcomes here. The last role I'll have is to highlight some of the areas in which positive results are being seen and where the Latino community wants to emphasize the positive action taken by this level of government. ONE's Diversity and Civic Leadership Program and the Portland Plan with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability have seen significant investments in the leadership development of the Latino community. The heightened role of the community in the East Portland Action Plan is similarly affirmed, as are movements to increase equity in arts funding, specifically through the Regional Arts and Culture Council. And the efforts under Commissioner Fritz's leadership in terms of census work and, oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Fish.
But it was only the mayor.
I apologize.
We all look together.
Those F names, they're hard.
There are some cues I can share with you that distinguish us. But
yeah, he has glasses.
I apologize. The improved involvement of community groups and efforts during through the Complete Count Committee for Census 2010 and the efforts to improve the homelessness count are certainly recognized and affirmed by the Latino community. And mentioned earlier, the Housing Bureau's efforts to bring an equity lens forward in terms of setting targets and aiming to reduce disparities and set some priorities around that is very much valued. And with that, I pass the lead to Pietro.
Good morning. My name is Pietro Ferrari. I'm here in my triple capacity. Actually, I'm executive director of Catholic Charities, which also encompasses El Programa Hispano, which one of the largest Latino-focused programs in our city, and also as a first-generation immigrant, active member of the Latino community. This morning, I'd like to acknowledge the spiritual presence of one of our esteemed leader and friend that we lost last December, Gloria Wiggins. I'm sure that you know her and you've known of her work. Her tireless work in service to our community is recognized not only in East County, but here in Portland. She left an enduring legacy for us to honor and to follow, and we have that legacy to continue. My colleagues and I prepared some recommendations following the study here, but we want to really listen and invite you to listen and reflect on this study, because while the statistics are startling, they are not surprising to us. We live with these statistics day to day. There's an old saying in Spanish that says, a grandes males, grandes remedios, to great challenges, great remedies. We acknowledge the city of Portland that has been a key ally to the Latino community with a proven track record of support in early childhood, school-age children, education, community and safety, civic engagement, affordable housing, and others. And we thank you for those. From this baseline of support, we have a unique opportunity to seize our moment in history here together with the established leaders and credible organizations that are represented here and beyond. And we'd like to build up from Mayor Adams' vision to call it the Portland for People. And this is a core values that we share of a prosperous, healthy, educated, and equitable. And the recommendations that we prepared for you, while are not limited to this list, they'll give you some sense of where we want to start our dialogue. Primarily and most importantly is to continue to expand support for culturally specific programs that address key sectors of the study, like education, income, and health, prioritizing use of community verified data so that investments in the community reflect the intentional desire to reverse the negative trending and close the gaps that were called in the study. There are some success stories that you've heard from Anne. I would like to highlight the important investments that the city makes in the Sun schools, community schools with that have a larger Latino populations. David Douglas, 20% Latinos, Park Rose, 21% Latinos, Centennial, 23% Latinos, and Lane Middle School, 29% Latinos. The initiative called Nine Great Count is working. So is the Future Connect and the C3 College and Career Connections. Those are very key initiatives that are working. I would like to highlight, applaud them and I would like to encourage continued support on them. Another victory, so to speak, is youth violence prevention program. I think if you can invest and continue the basic infrastructure that we have, I would highlight that because of our work in prevention. And I think Latino Network is doing a lot on gang intervention. They go together, and so your leadership will help us keep our youth, you know, in out of trouble. We would like also to encourage you to create and foster opportunities for civic engagement for Latinos in policy, in budget, in planning, and in evaluation. For example, you